Evening all. Welcome to our Bible class this evening. We've got Brother David Herman who's joining us from Adelaide. David's going to be giving us a discourse on the woman of Samaria, a story I think we know reasonably well, but I'm certain David's going to bring out some lessons for us. So no prizes for guessing what the reading is, but if you're talking the woman of Samaria, John chapter 4 is where we would be going. And we're going to read the first 42 verses of John chapter 4. Okay, David, thank you.
So, this is a very familiar story, so it's a bit of a risky thing to take on, but I've had for a long time a suspicion that there's a lot more to this than we might realise, and I think I've learnt from others that I've investigated that there really is a lot more in this story. There are a lot of absolutely surprising things about it, to be honest, and it actually raises questions for us that are worth us recognising and understanding. And so let's get into it and see some of these things. The story begins with Jesus saying that he must pass through Samaria. And that in itself is a surprising thing to do, because if he's on the way from Jerusalem to Galilee, then he doesn't have to pass through Samaria. In fact, as you probably all know, it's pretty unusual for people to do that. They hated the Samaritans, so they would normally go a long way around, that doubled the journey from 3 days to 6 days to get from Jerusalem to Galilee. And there appears to be no clear indication as to why he says that he must pass through Samaria. And everybody else certainly chooses not to do so. I'm going to try and give you my answer right at the very end as to why. So I'm not going to answer that question right now. So what we need to recognise is that in the nation at that time, there were two groups, and they were quite different and separate generally. So the Samaritan, put that up there. Has anybody got an answer to that question? Does anybody suggest why he said he must go through Samaria? Sorry, before. Pardon? How would he know he was going to meet the woman? How does he know?
Ben? It's more about the place of Shechem. He had to go through Shechem.
Shechem and Sychar are pretty much the same name, so everyone's convinced they're the same thing. I'm still not getting a clear sense of why we think that's important. Seeing as everybody else didn't go that way.
That phrase that he must is used in the Gospel of John to
speak of
God's plan.
So I think that's a bit closer to the mark. If, pardon? Yes, and we'll come back to that idea. I actually think that if Jesus says he must go through Samaria, then I think God's directed to him to do that. I don't know whether I'm overstating the case, but I actually believe that everything Jesus did in his ministry was directed by God. He actually knew when he went through the last stretch to Jerusalem that he ought to see someone up in a tree. How did he know that was going to happen? Well, I believe God told him. God told him what to say and how to say it. And I think he actually gave him the rundown of each thing that he would do each day. And so there was a specific purpose for him to go through Samaria and meet this woman. Now, just to give a little bit of background, there are two groups in Israel, which are best called the Samaritan Israelites and the Jewish Israelites, and they had some very different beliefs, and they differed on four key points. But before I get into that, I'm just going to give you a modern analogy. These are very much like the Sunni and the Shia Muslims. Now, they both consider themselves genuine Muslims, but they hate each other. And as far as they're concerned, they're enemies. They fight against each other at times. Actually, I'm wondering if I'm loud enough. So they have two groups that are very different in their approach. And we do need to clarify the word Samaritan, because that actually can apply in two different ways. The group that we're going to look at tonight are the ones that are there in the woman's time. And they are people who were in Samaria before they were taken away to Assyria. And they were people that were upholding the law of God. They were serious about what God had taught in the first five books of the Bible. And there's another group we also call Samaritans, who were the people who were brought in by the Assyrians to intermingle and intermarry with the people in Samaria after the invasion. So one group, in fact, is a group that were seeking to fear God and live by his ways. And there were others, of course, who actually destroyed the proper beliefs and practices of the people in that area. So it's interesting just that there were people who were godly all the way through those terrible days, where not a single king in the northern nation of Israel, there were still people who genuinely searched for God's ways and upheld them. In fact, the Samaritan Israelites regard themselves as what they call the Kutim or the Kutites, which means the keepers of the old ways, maintaining the old ancient faith, the traditions, the covenants, the promises, and they preserved the sense of awe of all that Moses taught. And in fact, they were only ever interested in talking about what was in the first five books of the Bible. They knew very little of the rest of what we take as the Old Testament. The Samaritans actually had their own Greek translation of the Torah, which they called the Samaritikon. Should have practiced that. And they believed that that was the true original Torah, except in Greek, while the Judean Israelites had a version influenced more by the Babylonian Jews. Jesus referred to Samaritans to the Jews, and I think if we think about some of the detail of the story of the Good Samaritan, we actually learn some of the differences that are significant. So, in the parable of the Good Samaritan, none of the travellers initially realised that the man who was beaten was still alive. There was a priest and a Nazirite who were not allowed to become unclean for a relative, but were allowed to do so for an abandoned dead body. But they chose not to do so in Jesus' story. For ancient Samaritan rabbis, priestly purity was secondary to the deeds of kindness that God expected. So Jesus showed the Samaritan putting kindness ahead of the ritual required by the law. The Samaritan intended to bury the man, but in the process of moving the man, he found out that he was alive. Of course, the others might have been aware of that too if they'd actually cared enough. So Jesus indicated the priority of compassion over the ritual of the law. That was something that Jesus was trying to teach the Jews. The Jews struggled with this idea that all you really had to do was just obey the letter of the law and forget about the spirit of the law or the intention of the law that God intended. So Jesus had already put the possibility in people's minds amongst the Jews that in fact the Samaritans were not totally bad. And this was something, of course, that Jesus was trying to teach. And he's just come back from Jerusalem, where he's been rejected. And I personally think he's hoping for a much better response from the Samaritans. So the Samaritans actually had four key differences compared to the Jewish Israelites. And I'll put them up there. They believed that you should worship God at Mount Gerizim, which is what they had always done. They should only rely on the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, because they are Moses' words. They should only rely on Moses as the prophet. And they rejected the Davidic dynasty, because, of course, they rejected all of the other books that we take in the Old Testament. So Jesus stopped at the well at Sychar, as he felt he needed to do. It's in the vicinity of Mount Gerizim. And John mentions that Jacob had given this plot of land to Joseph, where his bones were probably buried, according to Joshua 24, verse 32. And the first thing to confront us is that there was a well there, and a woman came to draw water at the sixth hour, possibly the hottest time of the day. What do we normally infer from that?
She's coming when no one else is.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately a bit of an assumption, and we can't be sure that that is possibly the reason at all. In fact, we don't even know what time of the year it is. So it could have been quite a normal temperature day. And unfortunately, I think we make a lot of assumptions in this story about the woman. So we're just simply not told why she came at noon. So we need to actually be careful of unfounded assumptions about people, and particularly this woman. Jesus asked the woman to give her a drink. She asked how he can give her better water. Jesus asked the woman to give her a drink. She asked him how he can give her better water without even having a bucket. Just in passing, this story is actually written in present tense in the original, but it's normally translated in the past tense. Present tense makes it much more dramatic. So, Jesus offered this water that he could supply, and she said she would like to have this source of water that she does not have, so that she doesn't have to keep coming to draw water from the well. Jesus said if she knew the gift of God and who Jesus really was, then she would ask him for living, flowing water. Living water, flowing water means the same thing in the original. So her response suggests that she understood him to mean that he had a better source of water than that they could provide from that spring. And she had no idea that he was alluding to some form of spiritual water. I'm feeling the need for some water myself. So she asks if he is greater than Jacob, their ancestor, who gave them the well and used it as a source of drinking water for himself and his cattle. And in the process of that, she's made it obvious that she's fairly familiar with the stories of the patriarchs and their wells, which was in those areas a considerable difficulty. Maintaining a source of water was always a problem. So Jesus is contrasting the water from the well with the water that he could give her, but she's still thinking of a natural water source. A well provides water that quenches the thirst for a short time, but the water that Jesus wants to provide us will become like an internal fountain that keeps springing upwards in a person, leading them to eternal life. So what does Jesus mean by this? What's he referring to, this living water? Some hard thinking going on. Okay. She may not have understood straight away, but yeah, the question is just was, what does Jesus mean there? And I think your answer makes sense. It's his words, what he can teach, that gives us life. Yep. Tanya? Yeah. Something that is so eternal that it is always going to be there. No matter what goes wrong in your life or whether there's a drought or whatever, there's a source of something that keeps you going. Something lasting, everlasting. And it's going to be satisfying. We're always finding ourselves disappointed with whatever we buy or whatever we try and accomplish. We never quite achieve what we want. But this living water is bringing us up to an eternal, wonderful future that God wants to supply to us all. I would hope so, yes. Yeah.
Which is always a danger at a well. You get to a well and maybe something hasn't maintained it.
True. We're not very familiar with that, are we? So they wouldn't have thought anything of, or couldn't have imagined having water coming out of a tap from your kitchen. So how do we access this living water that Jesus supplies, because he's offering it up to us as well? It's not a complicated question. Scripture is our main source. What's another good source? Each other. Talk to one another. We can all encourage one another. We can each help others, thinking constantly, even in difficulties, of what we have to look forward to. Prayer is another big help too. You know, we can bring our concerns to God and feel refreshed by having left our problems with him. So it's really all about a relationship that is going to be eternal and lasting for all of our life and then the future to come. Jesus starts to begin to show who he is to this woman. And he does this by telling the woman to go and get her husband. Now, the word husband in it would be Greek at this stage, or is that Hebrew? I can't remember now. The word arne, and the word is both, man and husband. So it's a little confusing because we think of those things as potentially two different things. So she says she has had five husbands or five men, and that man she is currently living with is not her husband. So what do we assume from that? Let me ask a different question. What do we normally assume from that? She's a bad wife. Yeah, that's a possibility. There's one particular word that comes to mind that is normally imposed as a... Yeah. Most people consider that she's a young, promiscuous woman. Is there anything in the story that actually infers that that is true? No. None whatsoever. And according to those I researched, they said that no one would be able to get away with that. If people were like that, they wouldn't be accepted by any new husband. So it's very unlikely. And it also doesn't fit with what happens later on. So too many of us have actually assumed a great deal. It isn't actually written there. So what other explanations could there be? So, first of all, what evidence is there for the common belief she's promiscuous? Well, actually none. And Jesus didn't criticize the woman or infer anything about her character at all. Okay, let's think about the circumstances that might have occurred that would bring that about. She may well have been married off very young. Yep. Yeah. Is everyone familiar with the levirate marriage idea? Okay, so you know the story that Jesus says, you know, the wife married one brother after another until she ran out of husbands and then she was left alone. That could have happened to her. Although apparently the Samaritan Jews, sorry, I shouldn't call them Jews, because the Samaritan Israelites don't accept the levirate marriage idea if the marriage has been consummated. So it's probably not relevant in this particular case. But what other possibilities are there? Exactly. Yep. Exactly. We don't know, but that's certainly a possibility.
Why did she say that she doesn't have a husband? I have no husband. If they've all died and then she's remarried again, but she said that I don't have a husband.
Yep. The most common explanation I could find was that in those times, a woman was always considered to need a guardian, a male guardian. So it may well be that after having been through so many husbands, that she just then lived with a relative of hers, a male relative, who would become her guardian. They even had a name for it. It was called a gaura in Aramaic. Well, I think that she meant that she was in the same house as the man. It can. And we often make assumptions about that. But apparently it was normal for them to need a male protector. And so that's another possibility. Yep. Not sure about that. To be honest, given the fact that we don't have any great evidence that she has been promiscuous at all, I think we should reserve judgment on that. And it doesn't quite fit with what happens next, so we'll move on and think about that. But I think we should say that if in fact this is the previous life of this woman has suffered a great deal. To go through one husband after another, lost through war or death or whatever, would have been very hard on a woman. And so we should keep that in mind, that she has probably had a hard time. She may in fact have endured a lot of suffering. I guess if you've had five husbands, you probably have endured a lot of suffering. Yeah, sorry, that was the other one that I had on my list. Yeah, women couldn't initiate divorce, but men could. So she could have been divorced over and over again, which would have been just heartbreaking, I would think. So we get to the fact that the woman actually then acknowledges Jesus as a prophet, because he's been able to say, what you've said is true. So how does she know that he's a prophet? Should be a simple question.
Pardon? He knew about husbands.
How? He's never been to Samaria before. How does Jesus know what he knew? Has to be from God. The only way anyone's going to find out something that isn't known, it's from God. So she immediately recognises, for him to have known that about her, he's in direct contact with God. You know, not everybody would jump to that conclusion, but this woman is spiritually sensitive. Now, we don't quite know why, but she then decided it's time for a bit of a debate about the differences between the Jewish Israelites and the Samaritan Israelites. The Samaritans didn't accept any of the scriptures beyond the Torah, the first five books. They didn't accept the Davidic dynasty as the legitimate rule over God's people, and therefore they didn't accept the temple in Jerusalem, since it was set up by King David and Solomon. The Samaritans had their shrine on Mount Gerizim where they worshipped. The Samaritans were mostly descendants from Ephraim and Manasseh. That's why they were living in Samaria. And they believed that the Jewish Israelites had adopted the Gentile practices in the countries of their exile, while they, the Samaritan Israelites, had retained the teachings and practices that were taught by Moses. So these are people that were very serious about fearing God and obeying him and trying to carefully follow all that the law of Moses taught. However, they should have known from Jacob's blessings to his sons, which is in the Torah, made it clear that the Messiah would come through the line of Judah. As we know, Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and he's the one to bring salvation. So the Messiah is going to come through the line of David. Consequently, Jesus was exposing their incomplete understanding of God's plan for the future. This supports the importance of other prophetic Old Testament writings. Jesus wasn't just saying that salvation comes through being a Jew or believing Jewish beliefs. In contrast to Samaritan beliefs, Jesus is stating that by ignoring the other inspired scriptures, they do not know adequately God's plan for the future. He says, "The hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem you will worship the Father. You worship what you do not know, for salvation is from the Jews." So Jesus tries to move her more deeply into an understanding. He says the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. Now, there's a lot of this that is valuable for us. This is very significant teaching for us. Jesus was saying that worship is not fundamentally physical but spiritual. God is spirit, not physical, and we're to worship him in spirit and truth. It's not wrong to practice the physical aspects of the law of God, which often involve physical actions, but the emphasis is on spiritual worship, which I believe is a true appreciation of who God is and what he's done for us, rather than just as a means of receiving something from him. It appears to me from the story and what I learned from my research is that in fact the Samaritans were much more consciously aware of the spirit of the law than the Jewish Israelites. As we know, the leaders in Jerusalem were into the ritual, and they did things, it appeared, often with hypocrisy, so they could say that they did it. And we even know that Paul could list off all of the things he used to do to earn acceptance with his peers, but also trying to earn acceptance with God simply by what he did. And Jesus is making clear to this Samaritan woman that that's not acceptable to God. True worship must involve the heart. It must involve a genuine love for God and a gratitude for all that he's done for us. So we need to be careful that we don't fall into the same trap. The woman said to Jesus, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." The Samaritans had a belief of the prophet like unto Moses, whom they called Taheb, probably meaning the restorer or possibly he who returns. This was a more limited view than the Jewish expectation of Messiah, and was not expected to be a Jew or a descendant of David. The Samaritan woman seems to be trying to find some degree of agreement between the Jewish concept of Messiah and shows that she knows that that's a Jewish belief. She's used Jewish terms, acknowledging the Messiah as God's anointed one, so she shows that she knows the Torah well and is familiar with the belief of the Jews. So this is a woman who's is serious about the law of God and knows the differences between the two sets of beliefs. Then Jesus says to her, "I who speak to you am he." In other words, I am the Messiah. And to me, this is the most surprising thing in the whole story. Anyone understand why it's so surprising?
He hadn't told it to any of the Jews.
Yep. Not even any of the disciples. She is the first person to know that Jesus is the Messiah. This is really significant. In fact, the only other time that Jesus clearly confesses that he's the Messiah is at his trial. Now, yes, he talks to his disciples and they know, but not as early as this woman does, and not as early as the people, his disciples now in Samaria. He does later give some less obvious indications that he's the Messiah, but Jesus was operating on the idea, I believe, that the miracles were a sign from God that ought to make it obvious that he was the Messiah. The woman just picked up on the fact that he knew her life. From that, she recognized that he was a prophet. The Jewish Israelites just had no idea. Even with all the evidence that they saw, and the Jewish Israelites saw a lot more of the evidence of Jesus' power than the Samaritans. So, and the reason that Jesus, or one of the reasons potentially for Jesus not to speak openly about being the Messiah, was in fact that it would have caused a revolution. He was already in a lot of trouble with the leaders in Jerusalem. So this is the first time that Jesus openly identifies himself as the Messiah. It's surprising that he reveals himself as Messiah for the first time to a woman. Now, we don't always treat women as worthy of the respect that they deserve even now, but it was even harder in those days for a woman to gain respect. But Jesus decided to reveal himself first to a woman. And not only a woman, but a hated Samaritan. When the disciples returned, they were shocked to find Jesus talking to a woman, but chose not to talk to him about this at all. They respected Jesus, but they were clearly surprised that he was talking to her. So now we move into the final stage of the story, where we learn how successful the woman was as an evangelist. The woman left her water jar and went away into the town and said to the people, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" And they went out of the town and were coming to him. So she led, maybe not every last person, but a majority of the people out of the town to see Jesus. She was so convincing that they were willing to go and see for themselves this surprising thing. The disciples were still focused on food and water. They urged him to eat something, but he said, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me to accomplish his work." Is this true of us? I think it's a good question for us to ask and examine in our lives. Would we give up a meal so that we can bring more people to know Christ? Hopefully we would. Jesus wasn't worried about eating, and I'm not even sure he ended up getting a drink. He was at the well and he was engaged in spiritual things. There's no mention that he actually got to have a drink. So Jesus finds spiritual satisfaction in completing what God sends him to do. And that's something that we should find the most satisfying thing we can do in our lives. When the Samaritans came to Jesus, they asked him to stay with them for another 2 days. And so he did. And as a consequence, many more people came to believe in him. Now, actually, before I move on, I should make the point there that the Samaritan Israelites, in fact, became convinced that Jesus was to be the saviour of the world, in sharp contrast to the very poor response of the Jews who just rejected him. It has been suggested that John may have intentionally contrasted the discussion Jesus had with Nicodemus, which was left as an uncertain awareness of who Jesus might be, and the Samaritan woman who now already knows that Jesus in fact is the Messiah. Nicodemus is a pure Jewish, highly respected teacher in Israel who comes to Jesus after careful planning, but only secretly at night. And yet this woman is outwardly just filled with the message and going to everyone to convince them who Jesus was. It's a very big contrast of the difference in the response. So I believe that Jesus had planned the meeting or was told by God to initiate the conversation, which continued until she came to know that he was the Messiah, and then she took the message to the people of her village. So how good are we at preaching and making aware to the people around us that Jesus is the one who's coming to rule the world? The troubles of the world certainly may make it easier for us to get this message across the darker the times that come in the future. We should certainly take advantage of that opportunity as it comes. Another point I think we need to make here before we finish up is that if the woman had been as promiscuous as some people suggest, it seems unlikely that she would have had much success in bringing people to Christ. So, why did Jesus choose to go through to Samaria? Which gives you the indication that I'm just about finished. I believe that God wanted to tell the hated Samaritans that he had not forgotten them. He was able to get the response that he deserved as Messiah in Samaria, and this would have encouraged him greatly, knowing that the Jews had largely rejected him. In John 10 verse 16, he says, "I have other sheep that are not of this fold." This is speaking to the Jews. "I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock and one shepherd." And Jesus is always a person who brings reconciliation. And that's going to happen in the future in terms of the two tribes or nations of Israel as well. This time, he is bringing the Samaritan Israelites and the Jewish Israelites to the same faith if they would accept it. So I believe that he was referring to the Samaritan believers as this flock that he has become the shepherd for. Another interesting verse in reference to this is, John 8, verse 48. The Jews answered Jesus, were we not right in saying that you have a demon? Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honour my Father, and you dishonour me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. So the accusation here is that he's got a demon, but that may have resulted from the Jews hearing that, in fact, that he had been accepted by the Samaritans. Anyone got any comments or questions they want to make before I sit down?
A little bit off tangent.
That's all right.
There's only one river in Israel that flows year-round. That is living water, and that's the Jordan. Very like Australia or South Australia, we only have one river that flows all year-round, and that's the Murray. So the distances are much the same, incidentally. So when they're talking, when Jesus is talking about living water, it wasn't down the road. In other words, it was like saying to someone here, I'm going to give you a drink out of a river right here, and we'd all go, you're mad. So it wasn't just a contrast between still water and flowing water, because there wasn't any flowing water around, never.
Yeah, that's true. I guess we take it for granted so much we don't even think about it. Yeah.
David, if you go back to your previous slide, I think it was the last bullet point on that, yes. No, the one that was the evangelist. So that was the slide previous to the one that you were just on, the woman as an evangelist. Was the heading? Okay, I think that final bullet point that you've got there, to me, does sort of ring true with the observation you made earlier about the woman, and that she probably wasn't somebody who was promiscuous. And I was just sort of looking down verses 29 and 30, where she's able to go and speak to the town and to say, come see a man who told me, and they went. And I think it's highly unlikely, just based on that observation, that people would have actually followed her if she had have been that individual that prior to the night.
Yep.
Perhaps classified her as being. I think that's starting to tell a story, I think. The people were prepared to listen to her.
So I've convinced one person.
Oh, you've probably convinced more than David, I would suggest.
Well, my answer to that, David, is I did have a poke at the word live, the man you live with. Very, very poor translation. The word, the King James has man you have, which is much better, and the NET in their margin recognises that. You can actually be counted. The man you count is not your husband. Right. So one commentator suggests that there's actually a parable there where she's had five husbands, five books of the law. She's betrothed, she doesn't have a husband yet, and look, here's the bridegroom that's Christ. She's actually in a position to take him as her, to be part of the bride of Christ, you see.
Right, yeah.
She's not actually married again.
Interesting idea.
It could have been her old in-laws. She would have had a lot of in-laws with all those husbands and social housing. Come on, family. There was an observation that Jesus makes in this story, David, and he says, and they say, 4 months to harvest. Is that an indication of the time of the story? Like, I can't work out if it's, oh, well, people say this, or no, these are saying, so maybe it's offense or
passover. Not sure, because it's, yeah, I don't think it's obvious either way.
I actually think it is.
Okay.
John, in these first few chapters, is unique, because the other Gospels say nothing about this period. So when we try and put the Gospels together, it's all John until eventually the other Gospel writers get going. And because John was there,
uh-huh,
Jesus, as were the others, this is a unique record in the scripture. And the timing of it, to me, suggests that this 4 months to harvest, verse 35, is actually literally true on that occasion.
Okay.
So in other words, it's springtime, late spring.
Yeah, if we harvest in December, so Christmas Day, then clock would like to start. That's sort of September, isn't it, in our terms?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Could be early winter, but you know, it's in that part of
the year. Yep. Something for me to follow up on.
There's a bit of a spiritual import as well, just a good one. These five, when I say these five chapters, from chapter 3 through to 7, these are all about water. Nicodemus comes and learns he must be born by water and spirit. The woman learns that she must drink the living water. The next chapter is he's by the lake of Tiberias, or Sea of Galilee, which is actually a source of the living water Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next chapter is the actual Bethesda, and the five pillars, and that is that final chapter of the five, all concerning water.
Even the reference to the water at the wedding.
You've got the women's that both learn about the messianic prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Just one more point on that, the woman bit, and a Samaritan. At no point in the Gospels did Jesus openly say in Jerusalem or Judea that he was the Messiah until almost the end.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the occasions, this is the first, where he acknowledged or said that he was the Son of Man or the Christ or whichever term, were all to the north. And the reason that you alluded to is that if he'd said it in Jerusalem, his crucifixion might well have been
too soon.
Years earlier.
Yeah.
And of course the timing, which he knew exactly, not only from the prophets but from his father, was that until near the end, he could not fully reveal himself in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And when he did, he knew that was signing his own death warrant.
Hmm. Absolutely. Anyway, I hope not have broadened out your perspective on that chapter. And I've picked up a few things as well. So thank you.